Judith Walcott and David Osman of Otherworld Media. They have been talking about this for years and arguing about it for hours to figure out exactly what is the state of the niche. And I believe the first question is, what is the niche?
What is niche?
What is the niche? So maybe we'll hear that tonight. In the meantime, David and Judith.
Get on that mic. I'll get on this one. How are you on that mic? Let's check. Mic check, check,
I don't
check.
Even know. Is this... Am I on, Bob?
Yeah. Am I rolling, Bob? I don't want to stand in front of you. I'm going to stand slightly behind you here.
So we can talk back and forth. Like we argue all the time over the coffee in the morning.
Coffee in the morning. This has been going on for over 20 years, as some of you know, whom we've known for 20 years.
At the beginning. We met at Western Public Radio.
Before the beginning, right?
We were the beginning. Well, that was before. Well, before we knew each other. Both of us started in community radio, which I can't speak highly enough of. As I have gone from, you know, the tiny broken-down booths of community radio to the alleged state-of-the-art facilities of WGBH, I find myself now, 25 years later, going back to community radio. And we're going to take you on a kind of whirlwind 20-year tour of what the niche was, what it became, and where we are now personally in our own niche, which is to say we live on an island north of Seattle. So wherever we are is where the niche is, as far as I'm concerned. And you know, and we've learned to be very adaptive in how we use our surroundings and how we make radio, how we make radio plays, where we think the state of the art is. I mean, you really kind of have to be a chameleon in this process. And I just want to take a moment now to recognize Tom Lopez, who had a fundamentally important and explosive influence on many of us early on. Tom was the first person who showed us that you could get out of the box, and that getting out of the box was a really good thing. And so, Tom, you know, all these years later, I just want to say, you know, you made a mark. It was permanent. On the Kunstkopf box, the inside the box of, you know, let's try to make this room as dead as possible so we can sound like we're outside, to actually going outside where it sounded like nothing that you could possibly have created in the box. So anyway, on that note, and now more about us. So I just want to say that we both I in 1979, and David, what year was it when you first crossed the door of community radio?
1959.
Ooh, that's very revealing. And I think that, you know, I think that over that period of time, we, both of us in our own ways, have seen the growth of the art form, the change in the climate towards the art form, the survival of the fittest in the art form, and then the few of us who just won't give up and die. So on that note, what do we want to say? We want to say that though we met at Western Public Radio and kind of fell in love at first sight, we really fell in love where?
Oh, well, as if Henry is prepared to monitor the levels, we will demonstrate where it was that we fell in love.
Into your right! Stop. Form a battle line!
Fire by file!
Form a battle line!
Ready? Take aim!
Fire!
The youth, still the bearer of his company's colors, feels serene self-confidence. He watches the crash and swing of the great drama, leaning forward, intent-eyed, his face working in small contortions. A formidable line of the enemy was coming within dangerous range. He could see them plainly, tall, gaunt men with excited faces, running with long strides toward a wandering line of fence.
That's The Red Badge of Courage, WGBH 1987.
No, I'm sorry. That was 1985.
1985.
This is a long marital conversation we're having here. And we like to say that we fell in love on the battlefields of the Civil War because, because there it was. That was the backdrop. And that was the first really major production that we did together very intensively in the small rooms with the buzzing machines. It was homicide or matrimony. One or the other. And you can tell which one we picked.
The interesting thing, of course, about breaking out of the box in this production is that although we were pretty much restricted to a format which not only no longer exists, but even a museum couldn't duplicate, which is 6 to 8, 12 inch or 10 inch Ampex machines lined up in a bus. And this is entirely put together with go, 1, 2, and go, 3. Now, nope, too late.
Too late. Roll back.
In one feed after another feed. There is no digital work in this at all. Superb engineering at WGBH, and the fact that we got out to Drumlin Farm to do all of those exteriors with 30 guys.
And the reason that we wanted to play that and talk about it is that the niche at that time, in 1985, there was a niche, and it existed on a national level at very few places. One was in at Tom's house. He had the capacity and the ability to produce solely and singly and get it out there. And then there was WGBH, which was the home of not only Masterpiece Theater, but Masterpiece Radio Theater. And at that time, people were making radio drama in series. They were half hours. They were once a week. And it was promoted once a week. You tuned in and you got that little piece of radio drama hit. And what I have to say about the times then in that form of radio drama is that, of course, it really was a direct result of the golden age of radio style. You were producing in a closed studio. You were using sound effects of that kind, or even worse, needle drops from the BBC. Yes,
even
a lot
worse
of needle
than that,
with the record pops and clicks. And
remember the reel after reel after reel of horses on concrete, horses on cement, horses
now,
on grass.
We were always
grass.
Looking for horses on dirt. We could never find the horses.
There were no horses on dirt. Horses and carriages. You could do, you could do Sherlock Holmes until the fog lifted, but you could never do the Civil War.
So to do the Civil War, which we very much wanted to do, we really had, both of us, and this is probably what one of the things that drew us together, is that we had an inherent desire to create an authenticity in the audio landscape. We really, really wanted to create that multi-layered approach, that feeling of you put on the headphones and you are transported. And I have to say that the Red Badge of Courage kind of changed things around GBH, because our colleagues at that time, Eric Bauersfeld, who is, of course, a wonderful producer, and Everett Frost, their approach was still pretty much locked in the form of this is of radio play, radio theater, the stage approach to radio drama production, which there's nothing wrong with that. But what we were engaged in then was breaking out of that form. And because of what we did during the Red Badge of Courage, which was to get out to Drumlin Farm, get live ambiances to record in. We took our actors out. We made them run around back and forth and shout huzzah. And in order to get authentic weaponry, every year at Lexington, they reenact the Battle of Lexington with authentic musketry. So we went out and recorded that. And this was, I mean, this all sounds pretty simple.
That's
but
60 or 70 muzzle-loading muskets.
Yeah.
That sound is unrecorded anywhere, unreproducible. Now, perhaps, in the archives of the great digital archives of movie studios, yes, probably. But in those days, it was totally inaccessible to us.
So from that point of view and at the beginning, for us, the niche was to for us to break out of the static sound of radio play. And out of that was born a concept, which really wasn't, I mean, other people said these words together, but for us, it had a very big meaning. And
radio movies. They came up with a concept at GBH called radio movies and hired us to do it. Now, I want to take you back to a cold October night in 87?
I think this was, it might have been 86.
We did this show three times. We produced the intros and outros, the raps for these shows, endlessly. But here,
that's called radio prison.
Yeah,
or purgatory.
It was truly, truly radio purgatory.
Here, you get to do the show you've always wanted to do, but you have to do it over.
Let me take you back. You're a listener now. You're actually listening to the radio, and this is important because this has bearing on the next little niche that we're going to take you to.
What is it?
It's radio movies.
It's radio movies!
Ah, good evening.
Now watch your step, please.
This way to the radio movie soundstage.
Ah, oh, nice to have you with us. Right this way.
Popcorn, popcorn, get your nice fresh popcorn.
Hello, and welcome to the radio movie soundstage. I'm David Osman, and this week our feature is one of the great British high-style comedies, Private Lives by Noel Coward, in a glistening black-and-white production from the BBC. All right, George, we're ready. Yes, here's Act One of Private Lives. Needless to say, nobody was doing that. Wait. On public radio. That was production. You heard what radio sounded like. What we wanted to do was to take what radio sounded like and make it sound like radio. Instead of sounding like one guy saying, I think I know. You have the notes, darling.
I have the notes. Oh, what came next? The chicken or the egg? Let's see. That experience, what we did then and there was very...
We did 12 of these.
Yeah, we did 12. No, it would be 13. 13 to be a quarter, so it must have been 13. Memory is slipping.
Right.
And then there was a political shakeup at WGBH, and that was interesting because for once in a lifetime, the independent producers left and took the money with them.
Yes, we
had... It was very unusual, let me tell you.
They had made the mistake of having us be the grantees of the National Endowment for the Arts grant that had been... They thought it had been given to WGBH, but no, it had been given to Judy and David.
Actually, it had been awarded to us. So, needless to say, we kind of burned our bridges, but...
But we burned our bridges with a nice check from the National Endowment for the Arts. And we decided in our next project...
And we created our own niche.
To create our own niche and to get even. And here's how we did it.
Coming up, 2 hours of vintage music for a Sunday night on Reminiscing in Tempo. I'm Rose Butler, and tonight I'll take you back 50 years to 1938. We were coming out of the Depression then. Business was better, more men were back at work, sales were picking up, and the big bands were thriving. Music from 1938. Stay with us.
Rose will be coming right up on the fictional part of today's programming, which is supported in part by a major grant from McGavran Guild Radio.
Stardrift, October 30th. It's a good night to see the South Pole on a world far beyond our own. More on that in a moment.
Partial support for today's programming came from you, the listener, and from a grant from the Urban Jogger Investment Quality Shoes and Chocolates in a Meditational Environment.
Stardrift, October 30th. The planet Mars has been in the news lately, having just made its closest approach to the Earth in 17 years. You'll find Mars in the eastern sky near Pisces, much brighter than any nearby star. Its ice-capped South Pole now faces us, looking like a white button on a rust-colored globe. If there were Martians, they would be enjoying summer in the southern hemisphere, a summer that might have once rivaled Earth's, with water rushing through the canyons and channels seen by Viking space probes. But now the channels are dry, and on the hottest day, the Martian air is still a chill 60 degrees. Our probes found no clear signs of life on the red planet, but of course, many people once believed that intellects vast, cool, and unsympathetic regarded this Earth with envious eyes and slowly and surely drew their plans against us. Stardrift is produced at Great Blue Hill Observatory in association with WGBH Boston. For the Observatory, I'm Joe Bloke.
Rose Butler with you for the next 2 hours. And tonight on Reminiscing in Tempo, I'm playing music from the year 1938, a time when all the radio networks broadcast live remotes from the ballrooms of the big hotels. And I've managed to dig up some rare air checks from exactly 50 years ago tonight. But before we get to the music, let's take a look at the weather. Not much change in temperature for the next 24 hours.
This is a public radio news special report. Numerous explosions on the planet Mars tonight have piqued the curiosity of astronomers worldwide. At Princeton Observatory, Professor Richard Pearson is looking at Mars right now with public radio's Carl Phillips.
I'm standing in the center of a large semicircular room, the observatory at Princeton. It was pitch dark in here.
No one in public radio knew what this was entirely kept a secret.
It was. It was an incredible. We didn't let anybody hear it before it aired. Well, actually, somebody twisted our arm. We had to let a few people hear it. So it was a tsunami phenomena. Doing the War of the Worlds, the 50th anniversary of the War of the Worlds. Talk about a niche. We picked up where the big guy left off, and as you can hear, we did something quite different with it. We set it in a modern context. We hired, in case you couldn't recognize it, Terry Gross and Scott Simon, and had marvelous fun with Joe Bloke, and Rene Aubergenois doing a perfect imitation of Joe Bloke.
And Joel Block was, and, who was
and in
doing
fact,
it in those days.
Now that I think about it, the reason that we had Great Blue Hill and WGBH in there is that we kissed and made up, and GBH actually did do the distribution. And they were really, really happy that they did, because it was carried by, 600
over
radio
600
stations
radio stations worldwide.
Armed
forces.
It was a true event, but we were just lucky. I mean, we got that. We caught this wave, and, this is part of what I want to say about the niche of radio theater, radio movie concept is that, no one is going to ask you to produce radio plays. In contemporary American society, radio is really, radio theater, the art form, is very difficult to realize. And we were lucky. We seized the moment. When we were at GBH, we had the great opportunity to speak to Howard Koch, who in fact wrote the original script for Orson Welles. And we did a snippet of it at WGBH as part of Radio Movies. And then we quickly, when we left, made that quick phone call to say, Howard, we would love to option the script. And it wasn't cheap. And however, we thought that spending the National Endowment for the Arts money on a nice fee for Howard Koch was only just turnaround, because the guy had been blacklisted and was unable to work in Hollywood for many, many, many years. And so we thought it was actually pretty cool to give him a piece of our National Endowment for the Arts grant. So
the other, just a couple of factoids about this War of the Worlds. It was sponsored by, it was funded in a great part by McGavran Guild Radio, who produced items like this boxed set, which included the 1938 production on cassette. And this is a very early on CD. This is a 1988 CD. The entire production was produced at Skywalker Ranch in...
Lucasfilm.
In... digital, using a Sony digital recorder that had just flown in from Japan, and mixed on machines so obscure that probably none of them exist anymore.
Yeah, it was the first entirely digital production.
24
entirely
track
from
digital recorder.
Field recording to final mix.
And the other little factoid about it, what this is a wonderful box. Except the middle one is just promotion. What this middle one ought to be is the huge documentary, because we recorded everybody who was then alive. And that documentary has never been made. We did a half-hour feature documentary, but the ultimate documentary has never been made. All the tape is sitting in our closet.
Yeah, the guy who was answering the phone at CBS that night... We went to, well, and Howard Koch, of course, the writer. Steve Allen reminisces about his experience that night, running out into the street with his mother, trying to escape the Martians.
We have Steve Allen talking to...
Doug Edwards.
Doug Edwards.
Yeah, Doug. This is Douglas Edwards with the news. He also puts in an appearance.
Steve and Douglas Edwards were talking to each other over the link. We had Steve in New York. Doug Edwards was in Florida. We had them linked. And they, before we got ready to tape their scene, they were linked together talking about their experience listening to the program. So we have all of this. We got, you know, like 20 minutes.
That's what we can do in our retirement.
Yes. And one other little factoid is the lengths of time that you hear the music played before the break, the breakaways, and the pauses are all exactly the same timings as the original Orson Welles piece.
Yes, that was our tribute to the big guy.
What Orson Welles did was to walk in on Sunday and cut the play. He walked in, because I have a copy. I have the copy of the original script. I mean, a copy of the original script.
With Orson's notes.
It's got all of Welles' notes. And what he did was to walk in on Sunday and cut a lot of slack out of the second half and increase the lengths of time in the beginning, so that people would lose their attention and then be brought back to the radio. And so all of those exactly match Orson's timing. That's what he did, and I figured that's what he did, and I would gauge it. So each scene is the same length exactly as it was in the original. Just a factoid. Well, then we were out for number two. Okay, now we had our own niche. Here we were, fearless. She'd call
fearless.
Up anybody.
Cold phone calls. That was it. That was my lesson. One of the things I learned in producing The War of the Worlds was I learned to be unafraid to call anyone. I mean anyone. I was calling these people who I'd never met, asking them for $50,000 to $100,000. You know, telling them what I was doing, pitching them on the telephone, saying, you know, this is what we're doing. It's going to be a phenomena. You're going to want to be part of it. You know, think of how you can use it. And you know, sending telegrams to Lincoln Center to try to get, I knew that Jason Robards was playing in a Eugene O'Neill play in Lincoln Center, and sent him a telegram. Because, you know, we really knew that if we were going to do this, we had to have top-line talent. We had to have names that we could sell it. It just wasn't going to make it to have the best actors in Boston. That just wasn't going to cut it for this. Not if you want a nationwide big phenomena. So I imagine my surprise the day I picked up the phone on Whidbey Island. I said, you know, Otherworld Media. And on the other end was, Miss Walcott? Yes. This is Jason Robards. I got your telegram. And man, I had to keep breathing. Jason Robards at the phone. Oh my God. Now what will I do? So I tell you this because I want you to know that if I can do it, you can do it. You know, if you really have a vision in your mind and you think, you know, whoever, who's contemporary,
Uma Thurman.
Yeah, if you think, you know, Uma Thurman or Gwyneth Paltrow or Ben Affleck or, you know, whoever
Tracy
you think.
Ullman, yep.
I mean, you would be amazed how many of these people just really want to make a radio play. That's all they really, they don't have to get in costume, there's no makeup, you know, it's all on their own terms, and plus, it's just so fun. So, both from the funding point of view and from the talent point of view, I want to tell you, you know, be unafraid. Be unafraid. My most recent cold phone call, which I think is the coldest call I've ever made.
That's right.
Was when I took the carton of milk out of my refrigerator and called the 800 number on it. It was Organic Valley. And pitched them on the community radio broadcast that we did from the Northwest Folklife Festival. And explained, I called this 800 number and got Organic Valley. And I said, can I speak to your marketing department, please? And, you know, I got the marketing department, and I started to tell them how their audience was community radio and that co-op milk was like co-op radio, and they really ought to get in on the bottom level, and here's how. And, you know, it took a while. I mean, they kind of got what I was doing, but, you know, it took, you know, a phone call a week for several weeks in a row, but my God, they ponied up. So, you know, you just have to have a lot of guts and be unafraid. Be unafraid. You know, just know you're the producer, you're the director, you're doing this. And if it's like on a local level here in Minneapolis, you have incredible acting talent in this town. You have wonderful people. You've got wonderful people passing through town. So that's what I learned at the War of the Worlds.
If there were a major star at the Guthrie, if Mickey Rooney were at the Guthrie and I were doing a show, I'd call him up
and he'd be in it. Yeah.
Because he'd love to do it. They all would love to do it.
Because they all love it.
But anyway,
to know something about this medium. Everybody loves it, except program directors. So, okay, with that, we thought we were on a roll. See, we had just done the most famous radio play with the most famous actors of our time, with people who became famous after they were in the War of the Worlds. I mean, we were riding the wave. We were on top of it. So we moved right along to, well, actually, I had a little snitty fit because, you know, he was already famous, and I almost didn't marry him on account of he was already famous, and I had worked really hard at being Judith Walcott, and now I was married to David Osmond, and, you know, I was not going to be Mrs. Osmond. So right after the War of the Worlds, I wanted to do a really big children's show called The Door in the Wall. I went and got Colleen Dewhurst the same way. I think I sent her a telegram, or I think I asked Jason Robards to give Colleen a call for me, and he did. And so our goal with this, what we'd learned, another thing we'd learned from the War of the Worlds is, you know, timing is everything. And one of the really great ways to get radio plays on the air is to time it with a holiday. So Halloween was War of the Worlds, and the next show up, The Door in the Wall, we were timing to make a nice Thanksgiving Christmas show for the family. And this is what the opening beat sounded like.
Bethlehem, Hello, my name is Colleen Dewhurst, and I'd like to tell you a story. It's called The Door in the Wall, and it's about a boy named Robin who lived more than 600 years ago in the Kingdom of England. The story starts in London, the city where Robin's home is, and where he lies in his bedchamber alone and feverish, sick with a malady which has frozen his legs, paralyzed them with a strange numbness.
Impressionistic, much less detailed, but very impressionistically done. Really a Hallmark Hall of Fame kind of approach to...
Still trying to make those movies.
Yeah.
You know, still trying to accomplish in a, you know, flat universe, trying to get it to pop into dimensions that, you know, we try to get to in our head. The psychological dimension. I mean, all the things I think I was trying to do there... You know, we had period instruments. There was a score, an original score for medieval instruments, which were actually very difficult because they've gut strings, and they were always, oh my God, the recording session was a nightmare. There was falling out of intonation, tuning up and replaying. And but, you know, we had a dedication to authenticity, and authenticity in environment and authenticity in tone, even though we were stuck recording that in Philadelphia.
Yeah, Philadelphia, as W.C. Fields once said. Anyway, we did find locations in Philadelphia that included an actual medieval castle,
yeah,
almost.
Yeah, it was back in, I don't know when it was, very fashionable to take apart buildings from England and ship them over. So we had a monastery. A lot of this takes place in a monastery. We had an actual monastery outside of Philadelphia where we were recording interiors. And then we had the Colonial Farm. We didn't play any of that, but we had a really authentic, could have been British, you know, English countryside. I mean, it was as, you know, those thick...
Half-timbered is what you're
yeah,
thinking.
That's
half-timbered
what I was trying,
walls. And so we staged a good deal of it outside the action part of the scenes, the kind of Errol Flynn kind of thing. We staged at this actual location, running from buildings, jumping horses, blah, 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 as almost, not quite as if it were a movie, but as close in terms of duplicating the sound as possible. Factoid, all of the reverb in this production is actual room reverb.
Yeah, it's right, that's
it's
right.
It's all in stone rooms. So the reverb is actually the way it would have been, and the sound of feet on the... On the cement and everything.
And the you know, kind of coming back to the topic, the niche that we were, you know, niche is an interesting word. You're trying to find your way, the door in the wall, you know. You're trying to get through the door into that radio station and get on their air. And so for us, it was a combination of, once again, trying to hit the mark of the perfect holiday offering, something very unusual in sound, something with a lot of music, something which... you know, it was very ambitious. It was ambitious. I'm not sure if I think it was successful now or not, but it was a heck of a try.
Well,
speaking of trying.
Yeah, then we really became ambitious.
Yeah, we got too big for our own.
I would bridges. Really love to play you our next show.
Yeah, it would have been...
I can't. This is it. This is not the Minneapolis telephone book. This is a 10-part adaptation of Gulliver's Travels. 10 half hours to be produced in 4 different countries.
Yeah, that was the goal. We were going to produce there are 4 books to Gulliver's Travels, and we were going to produce each book in a collaborative effort with all of the English speaking radio drama producing countries. We were going to do the raps in England with the BBC. We were going to do Brobdignag in Canada,
in Vancouver.
Vancouver, yeah, with the CBC. And Lilliput was going to be with the ABC in Australia. And, of course, Laputa, the whore, we were going to be doing in the United States.
So just to give you an idea, this is scene 4. a lush cinematic orchestral theme based on the overture to the Beggar's Opera, Gulliver's theme, underscores the storm at sea ambience. Strong wind and heavy waves. At first aboard ship, the creaking and groaning of the vessel and snap of its sails. In a series of crossfades, we follow Gulliver as he escapes from the ship when it crashes and splits on the rocks into a longboat, which is being rowed, then is overturned by a wave, and finally into the waves as he swims for shore. How long do you think it's going to take to produce that?
Alone.
Alone. Gulliver, old Gulliver, narrating over, "If I wrote of them, I would begin on May 4th, 1699, when I set sail from Bristol as a surgeon on the Antelope, which was making a trading voyage to the South Seas. On the 5th of November, after being overtaken and driven by a violent storm, we found ourselves in a very weak condition." That would be over the music, music down into the ship. "Reef the foresail and set it. Look lively, men. Hail, holy foresheet. Belay the fore down hole." Above the wind and waves, a tearing sound and a crash of timber on the deck. "Look, the split cord on the yard. Have a care. The top mast, the top mast. To starboard, to starboard. Half a cable. Rocks, rocks. Harder weather, harder weather. You let down the longboat. Aye, aye, Captain. Mr. Gulliver, Mr. Gulliver, Captain. See to that man. He's dead, sir. The wind drives us on the rocks, Captain. We must get clear." A grinding collision and sundering of planks. Huge wave. Quick crossfade to longboat. "Row, row. No help, Mr. Gulliver. God help us as we help ourselves, man. Row." Huge wave. Screams of sailors and the boat is overturned. Quick crossfade to Gulliver swimming. Gasps and exertions. Old Gulliver narrating. "What became of my companions, I cannot tell. I conclude that all were lost. For my own part, I swam as fortune directed me, pushed forward by wind and tide." The wind dies and the waves calm. Gulliver splashes and gasps. It's no use. The sun is gone. A wave. The sound of the sea changes to a steady pounding of surf. Dark. No hope. Shark at my foot. I'll be eaten alive. Be gone. Be gone. Kicking and splashing as the surf calms around him. No shark. Sand. The bottom. Touch. Bottom. Shallow. Can walk. It can't be far. Exhausted walking through thigh-deep water. Do you know how difficult it is to walk
thigh-deep water?
But I can tell you, we would have had somebody walking thigh-deep in water to do that. So, just so you know, we still haven't given up the dedication to authenticity.
200 pages of Gulliver. So that
But that was a bad year because Lynn Cheney took over the National Endowment for the Humanities.
We worked on it for 2 years before this happened.
Yeah.
Writing the script, researching it, doing all that.
Working with scholars, the most prominent Swift scholar in the world, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Cut to the panel at the National Endowment for the Humanities, and someone asked the question, is it really the purview of the National Endowment for the Humanities to fund adaptations? After all, who's to say what a good adaptation is? Isn't that really the purview of the arts department? Next case. So but actually, there's something a little more. Will we read him the first page?
Oh, the first page?
Yeah, try the first page. Okay, so imagine Lynn Cheney coming across this on her desk. The very first page, honey. The opening beat. The one you and I almost got divorced over.
Well, let's see. Well, no, you wanted a little bit
farther. It wasn't the first page.
It wasn't the first page. No, honestly, it wasn't.
Well, I think it was the part about shit falling from the sky.
Yeah, no, that was...
Wasn't it that part?
Yeah, that's scene two.
Oh, scene two.
Sorry.
<Well.
laughs> Yahoos clambering into the sound. The Yahoos clambering into the tree and discharging their excrements. This is a quote from the branches. Swift, yeah. Gulliver reacting in horror and disgust and slashing with his sword. Suddenly, with a terrified screaming, the Yahoos scatter out of the tree and run away. Into which the brutes climbed and began to discharge their excrements on my head, almost stifling me with their filth. Then, and
yeah, well, so there were some political issues.
I said, honey, it's in the book. We have to put it in.
Yeah, and yeah, I know, and our scholars said so too, but, you know, what they really wanted was the children's version, which didn't have any of that in it. And anyway, they changed their minds about funding literature in general, and I hate to think that it was our fault.
So we were planning on 3 years of making this, Mother, after we'd spent 2 years writing it, and obviously we didn't have any money, any job, or anything to
do. So I just want to warn you against, you know, like if you quit your day job and decide that this is what you're going to do all day long, every day, for the rest of your life, do have more than one egg in one basket. And be like the Easter Bunny. Scatter little eggs and little baskets all around the room so that when the one egg and the one basket drops, you've got a backup plan. So fortunately for us, there were, you know, people out there who liked us anyway, and they invited us, or they invited David in for a repeat visit and me for the first time to the Midwest Radio Theater Workshop, which has fostered many a talent and many a dream and many a hope in this field.
We'll take you back to 1990 and the play that when I read it in a boy's book of dog stories convinced me that I wanted to be a radio man.
The Odyssey of Runyon Jones was recorded live at the historic Missouri Theater in Columbia, Missouri, to celebrate both the 10th anniversary of the Midwest Radio Theater Workshop and the 80th birthday of author Norman Corwin on May 8, 1990. Runyon Jones, a classic radio play, was first broadcast by Corwin in 1941. And now, Norman Corwin.
I think that the love of a kid for a dog is basic and universal and crosses all boundaries, plus the fact that while it was a little ahead of its time, since in 1941 there was not much thought given to space and to wandering through the starry realms, this nevertheless is a kind of space piece.
I'm David Osman. I'm directing The Odyssey of Runyon Jones by Norman Corwin. It's enormously exciting, especially in that we're also celebrating Norman Corwin's 80th birthday in 1990. So it's a significant event for him, for this wonderful little fantasy, which has lasted for 50 years, and I think will go on for another 50.
Is this the Department of Lost Dogs?
Yes.
I'm looking for my dog.
Your name?
Runyon Jones.
Runyon?
Yes, sir. It is a terrible name, but Mother says I will like it when I grow up because it's distinguished, she says. The other kids call me Onion.
And what's the name of your dog?
Pootsie.
Pootsie?
Yes, sir. He's very smart, sir.
When did you lose him?
Yesterday morning.
Where?
Right outside my house. He's chasing an automobile.
Why?
He wanted to bite the tires, I think.
Front or rear?
All of them.
What happened?
The car ran over him.
And then?
He was killed, sir.
Oh, and you have the wrong floor. This is the Department of Lost Dogs. You want the Department of Deceased Dogs.
Where is that, sir?
Two flights up.
As much as I love this play, we're going to have to fade out of it. That's Dwight. That's the Reverend Dwight Frizzell, live orchestra, live cast, entirely live production at MRTW. And it's as good as the original, thanks to that kid, and thanks to the music. You can't do this play without music.
The reason we went from the 10th anniversary of MRTW to what you're next going to hear is because of Norman Corwin, who you heard at the beginning of that clip, and many of you in this room will know that Norman created the art form of radio drama at the very beginning of radio drama. He was the poet of the medium, as Ray Bradbury called him, and he kind of made everything that we do possible when he started 13 by Corwin in, I don't even know what year. Well, it must have been 1938 because he was in the room next door to Orson Welles. He was recording some episode of 13 by Corwin when he heard this incredible, there was this commotion going on, and he stuck his head out the door and saw Orson Welles running down the hall with a microphone heading for the bathroom where Orson was like recording voiceover over the toilet to get some reverb on his voice for The War of the Worlds. Isn't that right? Isn't that kind of the
something
story?
Like
something
that.
Like recording on the over the latrine?
He was always felt that, you know, it was Bradbury who introduced me to Corwin. And, you know, they are my two grandfathers in this business. Fathers, really. And so getting a chance to do the play that had turned me to radio back in the 40s, probably, when I read it, we then resisted as long as we could the extremely difficult problem of raising money to produce another brand new Norman Corwin play, which was a rewrite of his 1941 celebration of the Bill of Rights called We Hold These Truths. In 1941, every major actor in Hollywood had starred in this show, and the president had come on afterward.
Well, the president commissioned Norman to do this piece.
Yeah, well, Norman was the guy you'd talk to if you wanted to do this.
You know, they had Norman. They couldn't fly him out because they didn't do that then, so he took the train out and met with the president, with FDR himself, to discuss the radio play in honor of the Bill of Rights. So, flash ahead, 1991. For 2 years, we were trying to raise money to do a special in honor of the Bill of Rights. At that time, we had George Sr. in the White House, and Warren Burger was the Chief Justice.
Just call him Warren Burger.
And I want to tell you, and there was a whole commission, the Bicentennial Commission on the U.S. Constitution. I mean, it was big, but guess what? The Bill of Rights was in the outski pile. It was like, we don't really want to talk about the Bill of Rights. And there were like fights in Congress on this commission between Ted Kennedy and Phyllis Schlafly about whether they were going to give us our crummy $50,000 to pay the actors to do the show in honor of the Bill of Rights. It was unbelievable. And, you know, I almost pretty much had a heart attack in the process of making this show because we just went ahead. We just went ahead. We didn't say no. We got a little bit of money here and a little bit of money there and, you know, a little Amundsen money. And it was the weekend. We were recording, and I mean, it was like Star City over Idlewild. Here comes James Earl Jones to record the First Amendment.
There's
Lloyd Bridges doing excerpts from the Constitution. Harry, the entire cast of L.A. Law, thanks to Steve Bochco, who apparently grew up on Norman Corwin's knee, shows up. It was like they got conked in the head and they woke up and they were in the Bill of Rights program, you know? We had a cast of 60 people. I don't know. But in any case, it was over a weekend and I kept writing these checks, which I knew were going to bounce. $50,000
State of Nations contract. So everybody got $1,000. They walked in, they got $1,000, they walked out. We had at least 35 people.
No, it was 50, Annie, because we were 50. By the end of the weekend, I was $50,000 overdrawn. So I was nervous. You know, I could walk a fine line, but I was a little nervous this time. So we had money from the Pew Charitable Trust, fortunately, and it was so weird because we were sure they were going to fund it, and then they declined to fund it because they read the original script, the 1941 script, and they didn't know Norman was rewriting it and recontextualizing it and everything was going to be different. And they read that 1941 script and said, we can't fund this. This is xenophobic. We can't fund this. This is not about the Bill of Rights. This is about whoopee America. And I had to explain to them. I said, well, you know, that was the original script. That was before Norman was blacklisted.
Graylisted.
Well, he was kind of blacklisted, but he said he was graylisted because he knew a lot of people who'd suffered more. Anyway, long silence on the telephone at the Pew Charitable Trust. I'll call you back. Click. I'm waiting. I'm going, well, you know, I gave it my life. I mean, you get a rejection letter, usually you just go away. Not me. I'm on the phone. What do you mean you're going to... Rah, rah, rah? So, you know, another again, I never take no for an answer, and I called up that program officer, and they call me back in 15 minutes... and they awarded us $85,000. So that helped, but let me tell you, that was gone by the time we were recording those actors.
Come in.
You know, if you want to make something important, you want to make a political statement, you know, this was it for us, fighting tooth and nail to make a program about the Bill of Rights. Finally, it was an emergency phone call to the National Endowment for the Arts over a weekend. And that happened to be the weekend that John Frohnmayer decided to resign from the National Endowment for the Arts for what he perceived to be obstruction of the First Amendment. And as a statement, he decided to fund our show. And he sent out a press release and it ran in the New York Times. John Frohmeyer resigned today, and his last act was to fund a program about the Bill of Rights, stating the First Amendment matters. Sincerely yours. So it never stopped. I mean, okay, we got the funding, but then it was, we had all those tracks, and we had an uplink, a all-network broadcast. That was the other thing that was unheard of in this day and age. See, when Norman was first producing, an all-network broadcast was kind of de rigueur, you know. Well, it was the Bill of Rights, and all the networks carried it, and he got letters from all over the world, and Norman was very used to this. Well, we had the head of the NAB, thank you, National Association of Broadcasters, called up all the presidents of all the networks, of all the radio networks in the country. That would be ABC, NBC, CBS, Unistar, and Mutual, and public, and it was APR back then, but it's PRI now. And unbelievably enough, they all carried this program. It was,
and noon was the uplink.
Noon was the uplink. Oh, yeah,
that was about 5 o'clock the night before.
Yeah. Norman Corwin is rewriting the script.
Oh, yeah.
He's recording more scenes because it turns out, you know, it's a 90-minute show. That's all we have.
It's an hour.
Oh, it's an hour. No, he'd written a 90-minute show.
He'd written a 90-minute show.
And we had to cut a half hour from the script. And he went, well, we don't have to cut a half hour. I said, Norman, the networks are giving us one hour. And in network time, that's 59 minutes. So we got to go here. We got to cut. He said, oh, well, I don't know how we're going to do this. So he sat down and he started writing more scenes. I don't know how we're going to cut it. I'll write a few more scenes. And we love the guy. We started to record the scenes. We're still recording. It's 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, 5 p.m. Finally, we had to say, Norman, would you go have dinner now? We need you to leave.
Our executive producer, fortunately, he was in love with her, so he took her out.
Yes,
she took
Mary
him out
Beth
to dinner,
finally
got him out
Norman
of there.
Out of them. We could finally get down to producing the show, which we finished the edit on. It's a 24-track production back in the old days when there were 24 tracks on analog tape, and every track was filled. We had, you know, a 12-piece orchestra mixing and all of this. All of the, every track was filled. And we built the tracks, and we finished building the tracks at 3 a.m. We began the mixdown of an hour-long program, which was going to uplink at noon at 3 a.m. I took a nap.
Norman left.
And David.
And I expected to give him to give me advice that I could print on my tombstone because I didn't think I was going to survive. But he just left.
No, he did give you some advice. He said.
What did he say?
He said, when in doubt, keep it simple.
That's right. When in doubt, keep it simple.
Have we played it yet?
No.
Oh, let's play it.
The Bill of Rights became part of the Constitution of the United States. The most vital part. This program is by way of celebration.
It was about a half second past.
Norman Corwin's We Hold These Truths, a radio celebration on the 200th anniversary of the ratification of the Bill of Rights, with Richard Dysart as the citizen.
Americans like to celebrate, and usually we have cause. Not that everything is champagne and roses for all of the people, all of the time. Far from it. But if we stop to count our blessings, they add up. For one thing, we're the only country in the world for which multitudes are always, always waiting to get in. We find reasons to celebrate. Victories, heroic feats, holidays. Yet there's only one day in the year when we bang the drum loudly, when there are fanfares, salvos, parades, picnics, speeches, fireworks. Today is not that day. That day is known as the Glorious Fourth. Rightly so, for on July 4, we commemorate independence, the breaking of bonds that bound us to a despotic Britain.
When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political...
And that's how it sounds. Full score by Libby Larson, who's the Minnesota composer. Huge, huge, huge. So, I believe it was probably Baby Ruth's and Pepsi Cola, I believe were the available foods at the studio that night. And we did about 6 or 7 hours of that. And this thing uplinked at 2 minutes.
Was the only thing that was done that year in honor of the 200th anniversary of the Bill of Rights. The only program in any medium.
We have very few minutes left.
I know. Well, you know what? I think we should cut to the chase.
Well, you want to cut to the...
Well, but what about Empire?
Yeah.
What about Goldfish? What about...
Let's cut to Empire. Because the next big production we did with... We did a lot of these short... individual pieces, which maybe, you know, we can
some other time, some other time. But, you know, since we're still talking about niche programming, how to make a niche, how to be a niche, how to create your own space, one thing that was, I think, invaluable to us was to have an alliance with a major presenting station. And at that time, both for Truths and for what you're about to hear, Empire of the Air, that station was WETA in Washington. We were invited to work... first we thought it was in tandem, but actually it was just parallel track with Ken Burns on a program called Empire of the Air. Ken Burns made a documentary film about the origin, the beginnings of FM radio, and we were invited to produce a radio play based on the same book.
Now, the book hadn't been written. We're commissioned to do this, and I get the first 5 chapters. I start writing. I get the next chapter. I'm writing. Meanwhile, I'm researching all of these books about the beginnings of radio and Marconi and all of this stuff, you know. And finally, by the time chapter 13 rolls around, I'm saying chapter 12, I'm saying, Tom, where's the rest of the book? Where's the rest of the book? I'm halfway through this. What's happening? He says, I can't write it.
Uh-oh.
I said, Tom, what do you mean you can't write it? What is this? He says, I can't write it. I'm really having trouble with it. So I wait. Well, the reason he couldn't write it was the drama of the whole piece is the tragedy of Major Armstrong. He was an entrepreneur who was sunk by David Sarnoff, who stole FM from him. Well, I didn't know this was a tragedy. You know, fortunately, by that time I started to, you know, it was going to be a documentary about the beginnings of radio, and suddenly it became this huge American tragedy about, you know, a classic American entrepreneurial thing. And so, you know, did a lot of fixing, and then the second draft then became a drama. It had not started out as a drama, and indeed what the film was not a drama at all. It was a documentary. So I'm going to play 2 little sections from this, just to give you an idea of... This has never been released, so it will be shortly, but it's only been broadcast. The opening of this piece is an attempt to take you back to 1906. Then I'll play another excerpt, which is in the 1930s, which gives you a little more of the drama of the piece. So this is the open.
APR, American Public Radio.
Hello, everybody. Ken and Barkley, early in the morning on talk radio.
And good morning to you. You know our philosophy on talk radio is egg bun.
Everything's going to be okay.
Rock and roll revolution. I'm talking revelation, baby. Here's my man with a voice that's a choice. Mr. Otis Redding, sitting by the dock of the bay.
Now here's Holy Loki. Loki, give the folks.
Well, cheerio.
What a night in Allen's Alley, Portland. I guess the Senator is going to dinner. I can smell the hamburgers from here. Let's not.
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
Oh, George.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The shadow knows.
Speak to you tonight, the White House, the subject of thinking.
Lindbergh waves to the crowd. The crowd waves back. Oh, this is the most terrific broadcast I ever took part in.
This is America before the radio. Once upon a time, America. 76 million people.
Listening to all of this stuff, I do have to say that we have a style. And the style that we have is pretty consistently to have two things happening simultaneously, which is the world of John Cage. There's always an atmosphere, and often there is a narrator, as in the example of Gulliver's Travels. The old Gulliver narrates while the live Gulliver is in action. So all of the action scenes are timed to the narration, which makes it very that much more difficult to do. We also tend to use music as, you know, transitions in a kind of classic radio way. In Empire of the Air, all those voices, those old radio voices you heard, those were all actors. We used no old radio at all.
It was all recreation.
We used real music, but all of the radio, because you'd all heard these bloody excerpts from Golden Age radio before, and we didn't want to play any of those clips. So every little bit, every actor who came in, another 35 actor production, every actor who came in, we say, well, what can you do? You know, what old actors, what radio can you do? And so we got John Brown doing Digby Odell, the Friendly Undertaker. Somebody could do that. Somebody else could do FDR. Somebody else could do Fred Allen. Somebody else could do Jack Benny, and fortunately we had Harry Shearer, who could do everybody.
And did.
So just to give you a little example of that wonderful Harry Shearer.
Flash, Pat Bandino, John Dillinger, blasted by G-Man today, July 22nd, outside of Moon Picture Palace in the Windy City. Flash, Hawkins to Ben Burney and his lads at the Rainbow Room. WW Wubs, they're whippling with them. I'll be back in a flash with the Flash.
Thanks for asking us up here, Howard.
Oh, sure.
Great to get away from the city. Not counting my little excursion out to Haddonfield, New Jersey.
The future of radio laid out on Harry Seidenwater's cocktail bar like a corpse on a mortuary slab.
Now that Prohibition's repealed, Major, I think Harry will want to get all those circuit boards off that cocktail bar.
So the use of music is always in this piece used it as real. So people take the needle off the music. They turn down the radio. It is intrinsic to the life of the time, which was the essence of the production of this particular piece, which, of course, I had to cut down from 2 hours to an hour and a half.
Well, someday we're going to do the director's cut. I just have to make a few more cold calls.
We've only taken you up to 1991, 1992. And why is that? Because we got out of this business.
No, we didn't. We
kept we sort
a long
of
list
got out of
things
of
we're not going to play. We've got Heart of the Story, we got The Phoenix, we got A Water Faucet Vision, Which Way's Which, a cartoon for radio, a Halloween special, thank you very much. Goldfish, that was a mystery series we were going to launch, but we only got through Goldfish. Are we going to play? Well, we can't. It's too late. There's Oz. One great way to, you know, to progress your career is to quit and then make a comeback. Yes, that's right. We retired from public life. My great passion, why I started making radio plays, was for children's programming. And if you think it's hard to get a radio play on the air, you just try and get a kid's program on the air. Really, really difficult. I, in my naivete in 1979, thought, why, there's nothing on the radio for children. Perfect. I'll go make things. They must need people like me to do that, and I'm going to do that. So it was, a rude awakening to discover why there was nothing on the radio for children. It was kind of back to program directors again. And also the idea that children didn't listen to the radio, where I grew up as a TV kid, and I just couldn't. I loved radio so much that I would wake up for the sunrise sermon on Sunday mornings and turn it on and say, Mom, Dad, it's radio plays. Listen to this. And, you know, there were morality plays, but they had sound effects, you know. It was good. I believed that children weren't listening to the radio because there was nothing on the radio for children to listen to. I had a colleague who I met at Western Public Radio. How many people here remember Western Public Radio? Anybody? One, two? Oh, good. Well, Leo Lee would like me to thank him tonight. Thank you, Leo. I wouldn't be here without you. And that's actually true. Anyway, a colleague who I met at Western Public Radio, Candace Barrett Burke, at that time had an organization called the Academy of Media and Theater Arts. Anyway, Candace went on to go to the Children's Museum of Los Angeles, and though she knew that I had put down like a bad habit trying to do children's programming and put down like another bad habit trying to make radio movies, she called us up and said, "Hey, how'd you like to make a children's show?" I said, "What kind of children's show?" And she said, "Well, nothing you'd want to do, just The Wizard of Oz," which of course, the only reason I went into radio was because I thought someday I might be good enough to try to make radio adaptations of the Oz books. So naturally, it was very exciting, and it was hard to say no. In fact, it was impossible to say no, and so we did. Four hours worth. A complete adaptation written by my wonderful husband and collaborator with no narration. It was a big breakthrough.
Factoid. No production of Wizard of Oz had ever been done without narration except a movie. If you ask a class of third graders whether they have ever seen the movie, everybody will raise their hand. If you ask them if they've read the book, maybe one. So it was my opinion, and my co-producer, co-writer, agreed with me that this would be a not narrated production. And since the book is 90% narration, it required a lot of writing. So here's the opening scene.
Like, ladies, eat your breakfast.
Dorothy, come away from them chickens and dry the dishes for me.
I will.
Come, Dorothy, and wipe your feet.
Hey,
hold on. Dorothy, girl.
Yes?
I believe there's a windstorm coming. Maybe a cyclone.
Cyclone?
Go inside and tell them. Get down into the cellar. I'll take care of the stock.
Uncle Henry said a cyclone. Come here, Toto. I've got some oil. Oh,
land of Providence. Where's Henry?
Taking care of the cat.
Oh, it's a funnel cloud. I can see it coming. Henry!
Dorothy!
Dorothy, come here!
You think we should see what it was?
Yeah, I suppose it's some piece of the sky.
You suppose it killed the...
Killed the Wicked Witch?
Oh.
It certainly did. Oh. I knew immediately. Mm.
So...
4 hours.
So we got to do the show that we...
to do the show that I went into radio to try to do someday. That was...
And the niche that this occupied was supposed to have been the gift shop at the Children's Museum of Los Angeles, which closed before the production was in the box. So consequently, it has once again, you know, suffered an enormous lack of release. Special.
Well,
again.
That brings us back to niche again. I mean, here was this four-hour-long radio play. Wagner, but for kids. You know, we offered it as, once again, kind of going back to the idea of a holiday special. And it actually worked wonderfully. Stations offered it on Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's. Some stations played it all 4 hours on Thanksgiving. Some stations played it 2 hours and 2 hours. We heard from people all over the country that they got up on Thanksgiving, turned on the radio, and it was like the old days, they said. We peeled our potatoes. We were cooking our Thanksgiving dinner listening to the radio for what we hope is the greater good. I mean, we have a lot of arguments, believe me. You know, not all community radio stations. I mean, we just did the 7-station interconnect, the first time in the Northwest, if you can believe this, that 7 community radio stations from Bellingham to the bottom of Oregon agreed to carry the Northwest Regional Folklife Festival, now in its 34th year, live, together. We put together a 7-station interconnect so that these individual community radio stations, and we invited the volunteers from each of those stations to come and co-host with us, so that the idea of a community radio broadcast of something like a regional festival would kind of sink into the consciousness of listeners in the Northwest. Community radio. Well, how's that different? Well, isn't that NPR? No, it's not. And less so all the time. So, you know, where we're at now is so funny because it is so the opposite of the extreme level of production that you hear in our work. I mean, we're detail conscious, we're multi-level. We're now doing things, you know, with a single microphone on the street around a table in a restaurant, because the greater good of preserving access to the airwaves seems to us to just trump everything. And so that's kind of where we are now, is Mr. and Mrs. Radio. And
here's our theme song.
And here's, well, he wrote this song. He wrote this song, and Phil and Melinda, Phil Proctor of the Fireside Theater, and his wonderful wife, Melinda Peterson, in their alternate personae as Frank Funk and Margot Mundane. Yes, here they are on the Whidbey Island Center for the Arts stage when we began doing local radio shows for the local audience, and we loved it.
So if anybody wants to dance.
Even if you can't tell the forest from the tree, when you stand in front of a microphone with me, coast to coast our hookup is, but somehow we don't care. Hand in hand we steal a kiss before we're on the air. Oh, being on the radio with you, a million listeners hear us bill and coo. When we gently whisper,
I love you,
in your ear, a lady in Sheboygan turns the volume up to hear. Everything we say is broadcast far away when I'm on the radio with you. When they turn those killer cycles on,
darling, all of our privacy is gone. And if we should indulge in a single naughty word,
a gentleman from Uncle Sam makes sure it won't be heard. Only that alone behind the microphone when I'm on the radio with you. For everything we say is broadcast far away when I'm on the radio with you.
Wonderful, darling. That's wonderful. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Frank Funk and Margot Mundane.
That'll be back with me.
If you really want to do something, you know, important and big, go volunteer at the community radio station. Because every volunteer on community radio is a placeholder for every citizen in the United States. Every time you hear someone stumble through their copy or flummox a little bit, you know, trying to get the CD player to work, you want to say thank you for doing that. Thank you for giving up your Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Easter to be there. Because by doing that, they assure every citizen in the United States that there is a voice for them in the mass media. So, you know, I kind of want to say that there's hope. And a lot of it has to do with timing, presentation, and knowing how to target what you do to fill the void. I still think that radio plays in particular are wonderful for holiday events. For one thing, radio stations are always looking for something easy to do for their board ops, who are generally the untrained board ops. They practice on the holidays because everybody else wants to go home, you know? They don't want to be there. So it's a good way to kind of keep on the radio. And of course, the other thing that we think that, you know, we both in one way or other have practiced is that, you know, not all radio plays belong on the radio. They belong on CDs, in bookstores and conferences and children's specialty shops.
Alternative distribution, alternative marketing, other ways of doing what it is that we all love to do and want to do. Ways that we don't even know yet.
After The Wizard of Oz, David and I went back to our island, and we began to really think about radio in the big, important picture of mass communications. The fact that fewer companies are owning all of the air really, really has begun to disturb both of us who are politically conscious, if not politically active. What we did and what we are doing at this very moment is developing a program that we hope will be carried by community radio stations, because in our mind, the great hope for radio, for local radio, for citizen access radio is community radio. And the biggest problem we perceive in community radio today is a fragmentation problem. You know, what has NPR and MPR got that community radio hasn't got, besides money?
Why doesn't community radio have the money?
And why don't they have money? Chicken and egg, egg and chicken. We're beginning to see it happen with Democracy Now. But a community radio program which draws money to community radio the way Garrison is the cash cow of NPR. And so maybe it's hubristic. Maybe we're just fools. We probably are. We don't care. But we're trying to make a show called Live from the Islands, which we've been piloting on our island in a restaurant. I mean, it's so old, it's new, a husband and wife on the radio together, hosting a show in which we deal with local artists, local issues, local politics, and our job as co-hosts of that show is to put a global national spin on it, so that in our mind, the island that we live on is an island in anybody's town, and that community is island consciousness, where you know your neighbors and you know your local issues, and no damn clear channel is going to take that away from us. And so I started in community radio, he started in community radio, and we are now back in community radio.